Superbrain is a labour of love. Alas, no podcast can survive on love alone. We don't have a sponsor, so we need your support for Superbrain to stay alive and kicking. You can make a one-off donation by following the Support This Show link in the show or episode description.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hello and welcome to Superbrain, the podcast for everyone with a brain. My name is Sabina Brennan and my guest this week is Maya Rose Craig, who describes herself as a British Bangladeshi birder, environmentalist, diversity activist, as well as a writer, speaker and broadcaster. She is also described as Bird Girl, and I'm looking at a section of her website that outlines the highlights of her life so far. My mind is absolutely blown, given that this young woman is only 20. Today, I'm going to be talking to her about her memoir, which is called Bird Girl. And imagine this now, 14 publishing houses bid against each other for the right to publish her memoir. Her first book, yeah, you heard me right. Her memoir is her second book. Her first book, We Have a Dream, is shortlisted for the British Book Awards in 2022. She has shared a stage with Greta Thunberg in front of 40,000 people. She received an honorary doctorate of science in 2020 from Bristol University. She has featured in the Women of the World calendar in 2022 and the Greenpeace calendar in 2021. She's been to the Arctic. She's actually the youngest person to have seen more than half the birds in the world. She has rubbed shoulders with people like Sir David Attenborough, Dame Jane Goodall, Banksy, Emma Thompson and Billie Eilish. She is president and founder of an organization called Black to Nature, which she set up at the age of 14 to campaign for equal access to nature for all, but with a specific focus on visible minority ethnic communities. Much for taking the time out of your busy schedule to speak to me this morning, especially as in the last week alone, you not only launched your memoir, Bird Girl, at the ripe old age of 20, but you've appeared on a panel alongside big names such as Emma Watson, Greta Thunberg, Malala Yousafzai. Said it wrong. But now, ordinarily, I have to be honest, I would be very skeptical of memoirs from young people in the public eye. But you are indeed a young woman of substantial substance. And when it comes to birds, at 17, when you saw a harpy eagle in the Brazilian Amazon, you became the youngest person to see half the birds in the world. An amazing feat. But on top of that, you've made quite a name for yourself as an environmentalist and a diversity activist, with another incredible string to your name, being bestowed with an honorary doctorate in science at Bristol University in 2020, the youngest person ever to achieve such an honor in the UK. Now, I'll be honest, when your publisher contacted me to know whether I would be interested, they contacted my literary agent to know whether I'd consider you as a guest for this podcast. I knew nothing about that, about you, right? I didn't. I just got the bump about your book, Bird Girl. And once I read that, I immediately said yes, because I am fascinated by birds myself. I'm also obviously interested in conservation. And I'm not a birder, but I am fascinated by birds for the same reason that I am a psychologist and a neuroscientist, because I'm fascinated by
human behavior, why we do the things we do. And I am fascinated by birds. It's really good. You have a really great way of telling a story. And there's a lot of travel in this book. And you really take the reader to those places. I was so impressed with your level of detail. Obviously, there's an advantage when you're a birder that you, the whole point of birding is recording the birds that you saw. So you have some of that. But yeah, the atmosphere, everything. So, and it's not just a book about birds. It is your memoir. And I will talk to you later about that. You do talk about your family and your parents' struggles and your mum's mental health and that. Mm. But before I ask you to tell me about writing the book, I wanted, Maya is 20, right? This isn't her first book. You also wrote a book called We Have a Dream, which was published in 2021 and was shortlisted for the British Book Awards in May of this year. you're just incredible. But your first book involved interviewing others about their passions in terms of environmentalism and saving the planet. Bird Girl, of course, is about your passion for birding, but it's much more personal. It's about your own inner life as well and about your family life. How was the experience of writing the book itself for you?
Yeah, I'd say even though I had We Have a Dream come out the year before, like I think writing those two books was very, very different experiences, really. In that We Have a Dream, like you said, was a series of interviews of activists of colour, Indigenous activists from around the world in terms of their climate change activism. And Bird Girl is a very chunky book. It is thick. And I think, I don't know, I'd never done anything like that before. I had kind of a year, really, because I was starting uni the autumn afterwards. So I'd given myself a year to write it and I didn't really know where to start. So I just started. And I think in some ways it was a really weird experience writing it, because like you said, obviously it is really personal in a lot of ways. So I spent a lot of time talking to my parents, my sister about everything, about all these holidays we've been on, all the birds that we'd seen, how we'd seen them. But it's the birds where I started, really, when I wasn't really sure where to begin. I sort of just went, right, I'm going to write about this bird that I loved seeing and this bird that I loved seeing, and I can weave that into the wider story. And it was such an amazing way to start writing. But it was very funny talking to my parents, because we did get in quite heated debates sometimes about like how exactly seeing a bird went down, where they'd go like, no, we did it this way and this way. And I'd go, no, I'm certain we did it this way. But in the end, we all sort of came to an agreement. And I think the very first bird I wrote about was still one of my favourites to this day. It's called a sword-billed hummingbird, which you get I saw it in Ecuador, you get in South America. And I talk about falling in love with this bird through the illustrations that I spotted in the bird book, and then the reality of seeing that in real life. And I love hummingbirds in general. They're my favourite type of bird, probably. And it's just this amazing sort of jewel tone green bird with a bill that's literally double the length of its body. And it's just, that was, for me, that was one of the moments that sort of marks the falling in love with birds completely and totally and obsessively when I was 8 years old. And so it was amazing fun, really, to relive all of these fantastic birds that I've seen.
And you know what's interesting there, because obviously I'm interested in human behavior and how the brain works, and memory is one of those things. And what you've just described there is a very normal and human experience, is that, in fact, I've just done a piece around the fallibility of memory. And people often think eyewitness testimony is the most reliable, and it's the most unreliable, because you've just illustrated there. Three people were at the same event and you all remember it differently. And that's just how the world is. You all bring different experiences and you all have different perspectives of it. So, you know, writing your perspective is truth. That's your reality of it. But you do it beautifully, beautifully in the book. And, you know, as you said, then you started with the birds, but then you thread through the family story and the history. And I was fascinated to learn, because at the start, you know, you talk about that you travel around the world, and I'm kind of going, well, what kind of background did this young woman have that they could afford to travel around the world? And I was kind of going, oh, they must have come from kind of some sort of, you know, money, or do you know, but actually you didn't. Excuse me. And in a way, part of it kind of, well, your father had this passion for birds, but it also sort of stemmed from a needs must as well, which was quite interesting. And I don't want to spoil the book for people, because for me, part of that was kind of learning why and how. And another thing that jumped out at me, which, because I do wonder in this world, and you're of that generation actually, where kind of the internet has always been around for you. And you talk from very young about picking down these big heavy books and looking at the birds in them. And I have spoken as well on this podcast of picking down big heavy book that my father had, and it was about things like you know, genetics and hereditary and things about people and humans and evolution. And I used to sit as a young child and just be fascinated about by the images. And I suppose that sparked my interest in humans and why and who we are. And I just think books are illustrated books are hugely important for young children. And you see so many young kids and out for dinner and they're looking at iPads, and I don't think that has the same influence. I mean for you, like in your book, you talk about that heavy book, you don't talk about looking at images on the internet. It's not the same. Sure, it's not.
Yeah, totally. And I think, like, I've always been someone who has absolutely adored books. Like, you know, I was never one that my parents were trying to get me to read. In fact, there was a period when I was little when my parents were trying to get me to stop reading because I needed to do other things. But I think, you know, this experience of holding these books in my house, I mentioned it in the book, but we have this massive bookcase that's nearly floor to ceiling that's filled with these massive tomes that are just covered in these beautiful bird illustrations. And so
fabulous. Yeah,
those were almost a character in my childhood. And so there was something really, really special about that. And I don't know, I think when I was very little, I probably didn't go online as much as other kids did, in that my parents weren't very into it. I remember having to beg them for a pink DS when I was eight, because and sort of come up with a little PowerPoint where I was like, these are the reasons that I need this. like, you know, because we're spending a lot of time outside. I'm not saying like I didn't spend time on the internet, because of course I did. But I think there's a very big difference between growing up with the internet in 2005 and growing up with the internet in 2015 or 2025. I think the moment when my relationship with the internet truly began strongly was when I was 11 and I set up that Bird Girl blog.
Yeah.
And sort of launched myself into that online space and sort of became very entrenched, I suppose, because I'm still there.
yeah, and it is very powerful. I'm not anti-internet, you know, I really haven't, and I've used myself. Obviously this podcast is on the internet, and you know, I've found it very powerful myself at times to you know, get messages across, and I've found it very, very helpful at times, and I'm not anti it, but I do think that there are problems with it, and I'm sure you've encountered it being online. I'm sure you've had to deal with negativity as well, and especially if you're dealing with ethnic diversity, I'm sure there's challenges there. Am I wrong to say that?
No, not at all. And I think, like I said, I was very young, really, looking back when I entered the internet properly. And you know, I wasn't just being quiet either. I was online, and I was talking about things that I really cared about on my blog and on social media. And, you know, I was talking about climate change. I was talking about racism. I was talking about discrimination. I was talking about, you know, environmental destruction. And I think people just really didn't appreciate that. And I think looking back, it's very weird because I think I definitely got a lot more flack for that online than a lot of my like male peers who are the same age. Yeah. Like I think that was very obvious. But sort of as I got a bigger following and as I became more vocal, so did the pushback against that. And one of the things I talk about in the book is the way that that develops a lot, because it is really difficult. And I think in some ways when I was younger, I accepted it more than I do now looking backwards, because when I was 14, I was like, yeah, that's a part of being online and having a podcast. And now I look back and I'm like, who was sending comments like that to a 14-year-old girl?
I think one of my guests in a previous season, and I don't know if you've come across her, but if you haven't, maybe have a listen to the podcast episode or read her book. I think you'll find it fascinating. So there definitely, obviously, we know there's gender differences on in how people are treated on the internet, but she's written a fascinating book, and I think you might find it interesting. It's called The Visibility Trap, and it is about how the gender differences on the internet. And her name is Mary, but if you Google there, The Visibility Trap, her book is absolutely fascinating. She goes right into social media and how, for example, how Instagram, particularly when it comes to ethnicity, how it filters images of women on the internet, and how we only see the white, thin women and very, very few ethnic women, very few Black women on the internet at all. Do you know what I mean? That it literally, the filtering is incredible. It was just, reading that book was a huge eye-opener for me, and interviewing her was just fascinating. Given your interest in ethnic diversity, and I know your focus is environmentalism, etc., but it does matter because the voices are silenced. It's not just about the body image, the voices are silenced. But I think in understanding what's happening, it gives you a tool to help break those barriers down. But I think in addition to what you just say there, you know, my generation accepted so much more as well. You know, you just sort of was an inherent acceptance to a certain way. And then we stood up as well to a certain extent. But also I do think, so I've always been a very, very outspoken person. There's a part of your brain called the lateral orbitofrontal cortex, okay? And in people who speak out, who have moral courage, so they have the moral courage to speak out when, so we're social creatures. So normally, our instinct really is to conform to social norms because it protects our place in society. Excuse me. And we take a risk when we speak out of being ostracized. So you were taking a risk at 11 years of age of, you know, you were of being, you know, ostracized or being subject to abuse for what you were saying or whatever, particularly if you're speaking out against racism or whatever. But it turns out that this part of the brain, it stores memories of when we experience negative reactions or negative consequences of our behavior, particularly related to social consequences. Okay. And in people like us who speak out, that part of the brain is particularly small. It's smaller than in other people. Yeah. Isn't that interesting? So that seems to mean that we don't learn from those experiences. And also we are more impulsive and less inhibited. So in a way, it is actually easier for us to speak out than other people. We're kind of a bit more impulsive. We kind of, when we feel passionate about something that we think is a moral wrong, we kind of can't contain ourselves. Yeah. We feel impelled to speak out. And it's rather interesting. And there is a small proportion of society. And it's necessary that we have a small proportion of society who are prepared to do that. I find it interesting. I kind of find those things fascinating, and it's interesting to learn about it.
Yeah, no, 100%.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Anyway, when you were 14, then you also set up, which we're kind of talking about here really, is you set up Black to Nature. So can you talk a little bit about that and why, what it is, and why you specifically focus on visible minority ethnic communities?
So Black to Nature is essentially, it's my charity, and it's a
this is incredible, you know, 11 blog and then by 14 you're setting up a charity.
So Black to Nature is my charity, and it's all about fighting against racism and discrimination within environmental spaces. And I set that up originally because I think growing up in the countryside as someone who is half Bangladeshi, who has Bangladeshi family, I was sort of, as I got older, I was sort of increasingly aware that I never saw anyone who looked like me out in the countryside. And so I started, I started running camps in a very sort of grassroots project way.
How does a 14-year-old start running camps though? I started running camp, but how does a 14-year-old do that? Because there's things like insurance and stuff. No, you just started running them.
Basically, it was when I was about 13, I decided for other reasons I wanted to run nature camps, just because there wasn't anything like that in the UK at the time. And I thought that sounded pretty fun to spend a week doing nature-based stuff. And I'd been aware that there was a racism, that I suppose there was a diversity issue within environmental spaces for a really long time. But it was when I ran this camp, and it was very popular. A lot of people signed up, but they're all white teenage boys, basically, which nothing wrong with those. But obviously it felt very weird that it was an event that I was running, and yet I wasn't able to connect with people apart from that group. And sort of that was the light bulb moment for me, where I was like, actually, I want to go out and I want to get other people to come to this. And so I went out and I got a bunch of kids from Bristol. I brought them out on this camp, and I think at the time, because I was already online, there were lots of people going like, oh, you know, there are just certain groups of people that can't connect with the outdoors, which is ridiculous. And the camp was really successful. We proved them absolutely wrong. And I think it was because from my own experiences, I had then proven all of that wrong, but my brain was sort of going, but then why is this an issue in the first place?
And so I
ends up writing to various organizations and asking, talking about my own camp, and it's got bigger and bigger. And I kind of ended up running a conference the next summer, in that I sort of, these organizations kept on writing back and going, wow, this sounds wonderful, come and talk to us at our headquarters. And I'd write back and go, no, I can't because I have school. And so I thought, you know what, I'm going to bring them all together, and I'm going to get actual people, like actual adult experts, to come and talk to them. And my parents sort of gently went, you know, that's a conference, Maya. So I fell into running this conference, and it went really, really well. We basically had people from Black and Asian communities stand up at the front and go, right, you've been talking for decades about why this is an issue, you've never come and asked us. And they would just list the reasons why there is a lack of diversity, and why there is a feeling of racism within these spaces, which I can talk about in a sec if you want. but I felt really excited because I felt they literally gave a list of things that these organizations could do to make this better. And I was like, right, we've basically given them the blueprint on how to solve this issue. They're going to go off and they're going to fix it all. And then I remember I was just waiting for like months and months and nothing happened.
Yeah.
About 6 months later that I kind of had this realization that I was like, right, this isn't a one-off thing. This needs to be a more long-term project where I'm pushing and pushing, because otherwise just nothing is going to happen. And that's insane because, like you said, that was when I was 14. So that was 6 years ago now. And it's been a project very close to my heart ever since. But yeah,
that's the way of the world, you know. In the spaces that I work and have worked in, which would be like ageism, you know, ageism is as damaging as racism, you know, and with lots of, I mean, I know you talk about, and I totally understand it, our former president, I don't know if you've encountered her actually, President Mary Robinson. She's big in climate change and activism, and you know, she would talk a lot about you know, ethnic and socioeconomic status, about how climate change disproportionately affects women actually as well. And you know, but it's the same really with older people, you know, health issues, etc. They disproportionately affect older people too. But I would know the same. You would give the blueprint, you tell people exactly what has to be done, but then nothing happens. So there has to be someone like you. There has to be someone who is the driving force. There has to be someone who pushes it, or some organization who cares enough to keep on and on and on, because the governments, the, you know, there's always someone demanding someone. It's horrible, but it's the he who shouts loudest or creates the most, you know, hassle for them that gets what's needed. It's not right, but you kind of have to operate within those because of the nature of the way things work. And people say that democracy is, you know, is great. It's not. It's maybe the best that we have, but it doesn't really work. And I don't think that democracy serves. I don't have the other solution, and I don't think other things work. But I think by its very nature, minorities suffer under democracy. They really do, because it's majority rules. So by that very nature, you know, minorities suffer. I don't know what the solution is, but if people voted the way democracy is supposed to work, i.e. you vote in terms of what is best for everyone, you know, including minorities, yes, it should work, but people don't. People vote selfishly, and that's not how democracy is supposed to work. But anyway, that's kind of going off into another thing. So that's, it's kind of just amazing. I'm kind of really with you on the spending time in nature, and particularly for people who do live in cities. And I hear you, you know, around the globe a lot. I find it very sad that, you know, particularly kids, or people then who grow up into adults in cities who've never been outside cities, who've never seen animals up close, who don't actually even understand where their food comes from, let alone see nature or be in contact with nature, because all the research shows us that time spent in nature is really good for your mental health and your well-being, and can help you have balance in life, but also can give you space in your brain to be creative, to solve problems, and to gain insight into the world. And that brings me to another part of your book that I thread throughout your book that I really am, again, personally interested in. And you know, throughout your book, I mean, your mom eventually had a diagnosis of bipolar disorder. My father also had a diagnosis of bipolar disorder. Initially, that was called manic depression. That's what my dad was diagnosed. Now, your mum had clearly very manic episodes. My father was much more in the depressive, very, very severe depressive, which, as you said, in one way for you was somewhat easier than the manic episodes. And I can kind of understand that. Although it's very hard to be with someone who just wants to die. That's hard. But the manic is very, it's very uncontrollable, you know, And there's a couple of things that really interest me as a child as well, who lived through it, but also as an adult, that's always with you as well. But I was interested, I'll come to that part in a minute, but I was kind of interested in your husband and your husband's, in her husband's and your father's efforts to help your mum, which were, and it's interesting because I think it's linked to that nature being restorative, and also the shift of focus from self. Because I think with bipolar disorder, often part of the problem is just, you know, the rumination, the complete inward focus on self. And he shifted that. And I think from reading some of your book that worked in some ways, whether you agree or not, I'm sure. But basically for the listener, what Maya Rose's dad did was, and at this point, I think in initial stages, your mum did not have a diagnosis.
So basically,
you tell and you explain what your dad did, basically.
Yeah, so I spend a lot in the first half of the book talking about this sort of essentially mystery mental illness that my mum has. She was clearly very unwell in some capacity for a lot of my childhood, but we didn't really know what was going on, and she had been only diagnosed with depression, which just very clearly wasn't correct. And I think for a lot of my childhood, you can see this particularly in the chapter of The Little Big Year, I think my parents had subconsciously been using that sort of healing power of nature to manage their own mental well-being, both of them, my mum and my dad. And that's always been a really important aspect to our family as a whole. But I think it was only at the point where my mum was, she was sectioned when I was about 10, I think. And it was that summer that while she was being kept in hospital, that my dad made a very, very conscious effort to be taking me outdoors and be taking me bird watching, because he felt like that was what would be best for me, but also was really, really important for his mental health. Even though for us at that point, it felt very strange to be bird watching without my mum, because it's always been a family activity. And then essentially we had this big bird watching holiday booked for, and it had been booked months before my mum was sectioned. It was scheduled for a few months after she came out. And we sort of had this moment where they were like, God, we should probably cancel this. We probably can't go on this. And then they had another think about it, and they're like, actually, no, maybe this is the best thing that we can do right now. You know, like getting out of the country, spending time somewhere else, just spending, because on a birding trip, you're not doing anything else, literally dawn till dusk, you are watching birds. And I talk a bit about that very first trip, the first few days, it was really difficult. Like it wasn't some magic healing, you know, potion. My mum really, really struggled. And she didn't have the attention span, and she was getting really angry and things like that. But by the end of that holiday, it had so clearly made a big difference, both in terms of her mental health, my dad's mental health, and us as a family, that my parents essentially had no choice. It seemed so obvious to them that they were like, right, it's birds that we need to turn to when things get difficult. And since then, you know, the second half, maybe second two-thirds of the book is talking a lot about all of these amazing holidays that we've gone on and things like that, but the underlying aspect of all of that is this sort of almost feeling of necessity to it all. I think we sort of stumbled onto this healing power of nature just from the fact that we were incredibly obsessive about birds to start with, and it all sort of went from there.
Yeah, it's kind of finding itself healing. It's in a way, see, I think, yeah, and you do talk about your father's mental health, because it is very, you know, a serious psychiatric disorder like that has impact on everybody. Mm-hmm. And when you talk about your dad's mental health, it was really just this, you know, for him, it was the strain of caring for you and for your mom, but also he had stepped away from his own job to pursue his own dreams, and they were kind of, that opportunity was crushed for him due to those circumstances, so he was kind of dealing with that as well, and I could kind of see that, and I couldn't help when reading this, but and as you do when you're reading books, but compare with my own life. And my mum couldn't care for my dad. She, I suspect, always had her own mental health issues. And all she could see when my dad was ill was the impact it had on her. And it was, poor me, look what I have to live with. And that wasn't helpful, do you know? And it just became this vicious cycle the whole time, because my father's was very cyclical, you know. It was kind of probably every 6 weeks, it kind of had something like that. Later life, then it got much deeper, but when I was a teen it was much longer. I can remember when I was about 15, he took to bed for about 9 months, like literally just, you talk about that with your mom, where it just kind of became normal that she was just in bed all the time. Mm-hmm. And you talk about your mom actively going about killing herself and having very vivid, violent thoughts of killing herself. Now, my dad never, I don't know how violent his thoughts were. He never expressed those out loud. He did talk about wanting to die, but my father would have been, your mom was Bangladeshi, so she would have been a Muslim background. My father would have been very staunch Catholic, and so suicide is considered like an ultimate mortal sin. I'm atheist, and it's the only thing that I would see that it actually prevented him from taking his own life, if you know what I mean, because he was so, whether that's good or bad or not, do you know what I mean? But it is the thing that stopped him from doing it. Excuse me. He never had talking therapy, and he was always on medications. Some of them weren't right. I don't know why he was never prescribed talking therapy, but as you said, it's funny the way these things go. Your mom's family preferred to think of spirits or being possessed or those kind of things rather than a mental illness. And in our family, I was told not to tell anybody about my dad. Like it was something to be ashamed of. I don't know whether that's where the no talking therapy. I know I suggested very things as I got older, and my mother said, nobody else is coming into this house. Do you know that kind of way? It was just, in the end, he did get some different medication that made a huge difference, which was very sad, really, because he died very shortly after that, which was a shame. Excuse me. But it's interesting. It's kind of interesting. I often think this is what the other question I kind of wanted to ask you. Because you can't help as a child but wonder whether, because it is hereditary. And I know that I can achieve huge amounts. And then I have times where I'm quite tired. And I don't have any diagnosis, but I do wonder whether, and I do wonder sometimes whether we over-medicalize certain human conditions. And that if we understand ourselves better. So I wonder, like, whether my ability to achieve huge amounts in another context, if I didn't have a focus for my energy that is meaningful, whether that would be directed at something silly and then become diagnosed as something, you know, and then when I feel tired now and feel I've achieved something, whether that then would become a depression because I have nothing. Does that make sense? What I'm saying is that I feel that I have great energy. I can focus. I can write a book. I can do my blog. I can do all those things. And then I can say, gosh, now to avoid burnout, I need to take a rest. And then I will be able to achieve something else. But because it's focused, it's not an illness. Does that make sense to you? And would you consider that sort of a viable kind of thesis? Or
I don't know. I think it's interesting to think about at what you called, you know, the over medicalization of things, because I guess like my personal definition of mental illness would be when it makes your life significantly harder or different, or when you struggle to function in society. And I remember after my mum got sectioned, and the doctors and stuff made me go to talking therapy, which I talk about in the book, and I hated it. I hated it so much. And part of the reason that I hated it was because they'd always go like, how do you feel now that your mum has bipolar? And 10-year-old me would be like, that makes no sense. She has always been like this. And for me, there wasn't really a separation between my mum and this mental illness. And she, for my whole life, she'd gone through these, these depressive episodes and these big explosions of energy, these manic episodes where, you know, she was going to be the person to fix everything and make everything better. And she'd just always been like that.
Yeah.
And so that was really, really frustrating for me as a child, because I felt like no one really understood. And I think subsequently since then, because over the years, like, we have found the perfect combination of meds for mum. And I think even though it's really easy to look back and look at especially those manic episodes and be like, wow, you know, they were so productive, they were so exciting, you know, she's really fun sometimes, or, you know, she got so much stuff, you know, whatever, like, I look at her now and I can just tell how much more focused, how much happier she feels now that she has balance in her life. Because I think that's the difficulty with bipolar, is you can never quite balance yourself in life because you're always swinging one way or the other. Mm-hmm. I think that was difficult for both us and mum.
I think control is probably the slight difference there. And I agree with you. I agree with you totally on your definition, that it is when it interferes with your ability to actually enjoy your life, you know, to carry out your life as, and I do think we do over medicalize, you know. It's quite normal to feel down at certain points in your life, and it's quite normal to feel exhilarated and, you know, amazing. And it's quite normal to feel, oh my God, I can do loads of stuff. You know, they're just normal, that you know, we go through these highs and lows, and it's just important to recognize those. It's not good to feel totally out of control. Mm. You know, that's where it does get. And it's also, it's not normal to feel, you know, so far down that you can't get out. I mean, that's what my father used to describe. You know, he said, I'm just down this black hole, and it's just so far down, I can't get out. And that's a very different space, you know. We are kind of coming towards the end of our time. You've met so many inspirational people, so many of whom I admire. It's probably not a very fair question, but of all the people you have met, who would you say has inspired you the most? Or that's not fair, isn't it?
This is going to be a weird answer. Because you're right, I've met lots of very cool people. I've met David Attenborough.
I know, I have him down here.
Emma Watson. Like, I've met some very, very cool people. But I think actually, I was thinking about this the other day, and this was one of the lovely things about writing the book, actually, because I got to rehash some very lovely things. But I think genuinely, like, I know this is very cheesy, but this is also genuine, like, the biggest inspiration in my life has been my older sister. Like, the reason that I stayed so connected with bird watching and the outdoors throughout my very young childhood was because I had her as a role model to look up to. She is 12 years older than me, and I was a very, very cool teenager when I was little, and so I wanted to do everything she did, including bird watching. And she has just been so strong and so amazing, and these days she does so much stuff for Black to Nature as well, and she's just, I don't know, I love her a lot. And I know it's all very cool,
but I think that's lovely, that's really, really nice. I think that's really, really nice. How has your mom felt about you writing her about her in the book?
My mom, actually, because the weird thing about the book is originally when I was first sketching it out, it was a book about birds, and not really about any of the other stuff.
No, I think the other stuff is really important.
Yeah, and it was as I was writing it, and I was writing about us, for example, going on these really, really long trips to other countries. And I was like, this isn't the whole story. It doesn't make any sense. And so I had this realization it was going to be far more personal than I had originally intended. And I sat down and I had a conversation with my parents, with my mum about it. And she felt that that was a really positive thing. And she talked a lot about the importance of representation. And she talked a lot about like the importance of telling really, really honest stories, basically. And I suppose we both came to the conclusion that being very raw and being very honest was the best way to go, because there is still a lack of those stories out there. And like, I think one of the things that I felt was really important in the book is that the bipolar, the mental illness in and of itself, isn't really presented as a negative thing. It just kind of is. And, you know, I felt like that was really important because it's not going to go away. I remember originally when I was sketching it out, like, one of my editors made a comment on the very last chapter, and they're like, oh, and then we can have like a happy ever after. And it was kind of a joke, but I was like, that's just not how it works. It's just there forever, and that's okay. And so I wanted to show all the positives and the negatives of it all. And actually she was very excited about telling that story. And it was a very close collaboration with her in terms of figuring out how to tell that in the best way possible, especially in terms of the stuff when I was a kid and probably didn't really know what was going on at the time. But yeah, I think even though, like I said, it's obviously far more personal than I was originally intending when I first pitched the idea of writing a book, I'm so happy, I'm so excited with what's been produced. And I feel like I said, it's so important to have these conversations in just a very honest, relaxed way.
And I love it. No, I love it. And I tell you, one of the reasons I love it is because I think there's been a bit of bandwagoning in recent years where people sort of, everyone seems to say, oh, I have anxiety, oh, I have depression, oh, I have, and not in the real, you know, in this real serious sense, if you know what I mean. Yes, we all have a bit of anxiety. Yes, we all have a bit of depression, but these very serious, and I'm not dissing when people have anxiety or when people have depression. Yes, that's tough, you know, at the time. But these kind of very much more deep psychiatric conditions are very life changing and have very, very big impacts on families. But they're not always, they're life forming, life changing, and not always negative.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's the thing. I would say my father and mother's mental health issues very much shaped me and my siblings. I feel in a way they shaped me, some of my personality may not be, you know, all positive, but I think they shaped me in a way to who I am, and that's it, and to what I have achieved, and that's it, that's who I am, and that's part of life, and I think most of it is positive, and I think they've shaped you very, very positively, and you are who you are because of that. You would have been a very different person, I think, if you didn't have these things. You know, I'm not sure you would have been an activist. Do you know, you definitely wouldn't have been a birder. Do you know?
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, no, and I think, listeners, it is really a fabulous read. Whether you're into birds or not, just the story of it is fabulous, and it's an entertaining read. It's also, I'll always love a book that takes you to other places and cultures, and so you do get that as well. And the birds are kind of fascinating, but your family story is really, really fascinating. So what is next? You're studying politics and international relations, am I correct?
Yeah.
So my arrows in 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, any ideas? Or you
think? I'll not lie, I don't really know what I want to do after uni, but I think looking ahead, like the two things that feel like they're going to be very consistent in my life is, you know, the activism and the campaigning, that side of things, which even if it's not necessarily about what I'm campaigning about now, I feel like I'm always going to be out there. Well, it's like you were talking about earlier, I'm always going to be out there talking about issues that I care about and things that I care about. And I think the other one is just bird watching. I'm always going to be bird watching, and the rest of it can sort of fall into place after those two, I suppose.
Yeah, once you've found your passion, and I think you're very, very fortunate to have found your passion so early on. You know, I do think it is, because that's what life is all about. Find your passion, your joy, and then you can be present in the moment for a lot of the time. So I always like to end on, if you would like to share with the listeners, just one piece of advice on thriving and surviving in life, and or surviving life.
Yeah, both. I think, obviously, I'm very biased, but I think spending time outdoors is just so good for you. Like, obviously, I talk a lot in the book about how it helped me and my family, but we're in a period where even the NHS is doing green prescribing and things like that. It's so good for you. And I think such a nice way to do that is, again, not biased, is bird watching. Because in that, like, one of the reasons I love birds is because they're everywhere. You know, I've been sat chatting to you and I've been watching birds through the window. They're constantly flying around. You don't need to go and track them down. And you don't need any fancy equipment. You don't need the binoculars. You just need eyes. And so I think just going and sitting in even the local park and just watching the birds fly around for 10, 15, 20 minutes is so good for you and so good for your brain, and making that, making space for quiet moments in your life outside is so good for you. Like, I could not recommend more.
Totally second that. And that's actually what I'm going to do now. I'm going to work in the garden today. That's the plan. And what I love about working in the garden is the birds are hovering close by, and the robins particularly come down to grab whatever you've worked on. Thanks a million, Maya. That has been amazing. What an incredible and inspirational young woman. My name is Sabina Brennan, and you have been listening to Super Brain, the podcast for everyone with a brain. You can follow me on Twitter at Sabina_Brennan and Instagram at Sabina Brennan.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.